Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for
I'm
having
Tony Hook, Hook's Cheese, as Jim said. As I'm speaking, if you have any questions along the way, please just speak up and, ask me then so we don't pass over it later. I started making cheese when I graduated from school in Barneveld Cheese Company. Started working there during the summer and working there while I went to college. When you become a cheesemaker, you have to apprentice for at least a year and a half. I apprenticed under Bill Einotch for a year and a half, 2 years, and took my cheesemaker's license in 1972. So been making cheese a couple for them. So I worked for Bill. When I started, we had all canned milk. I don't know if anybody here has worked on a farm, but everybody put milk in 10 gallon cans at that time. Of course, previous to that, they had started using bulk tanks, and by the time I was done working for Bill, we had a few farmers that had bulk tanks, but most of them were older and planning on retiring, so they just kept doing it in the cans. From 1970 to 1976, I worked for Bill, and then we moved to Mineral Point and took over a small cooperative cheese factory called Buck Grove. All those farms were bulk when we got there, so a little less hard on the back. When you're younger, it doesn't seem to faze you. I don't think I'd want to lift all those cans these days.
Won't let me mute it.
So the farms we had at Buck Grove, we actually still get milk from the same farms that we were getting then, but many of them have retired. So we're down to a few farms, but very small farms, about 45 cows is the biggest that we have. So we don't deal with any of the big companies that have big farms that have 35 or 4,000 cows. We try to stick with small family farms and keep them in business. Started at Buck Grove. We were making mainly 64-pound blocks of cheddar cheese. When I worked at Bill's, we had made cheddar, some Monterey Jack, and some Emmentaler. When Bill started making, he had made the big 200-pound wheels of Emmentaler. And when I started there, he had switched to vats from the kettles, but we still would make one wheel of Swiss about every 2 or 3 months because we were right on the road in Barneveld. So tourists coming through, plus all the town folk, were used to getting Swiss cheese from him. So I learned to make Swiss, Colby, Monterey Jack, cheddar. When we moved to Buck Grove, we were mainly making cheddar for Borden's for the first several years. And then Borden's decided they were going to pull out of Southwest Wisconsin, and we started making more Colby, Monterey, Pepper Jack, Baby Swiss. In 1982, we entered a vat, one block of Colby from one vat in the World Championship, and in my name, and one block from my wife Julie's from one vat. And Julie's won first place in the class. I judge every class against each other for the top prize, and hers won the overall World Championship.
Oh, wow.
So Julie is the only woman to have ever won that.
That's really cool.
There and up to now. But one aside from that is that nowadays, most places, just like we do, we enter everything as Team Hook. Most places enter it under the team that's made the vat. And the last one that in the US that's won it was 2016, Emmy Roth in Monroe. And I imagine there's some women on the team down there. I don't know, but I wouldn't imagine. So, but she's the only individual woman to have ever won it. So, even more for us. So from there, we kind of grew our pulpy business. And by 1987, we had kind of outgrown Buck Grove Cooperative. It was pretty small. The factory was small. And the pasteurizer regulations were being upgraded at the time. The PMO for the whole nation, they wanted milk that was pasteurized to be pasteurized with Flotabert valves and pasteurizer charts, so everything was recorded. And we didn't have that out of Buck Grove. The farmers didn't really want to spend the money to put that in. And the facility in Mineral Point was available for sale at that time. It was sitting idle for a couple of months.
And continue on to Seminole Highway.
And so we bought the facility in town. The farmers all came in there with us and closed the co-op down. And like I said earlier, we still got milk from the same farms that we were getting. When we bought that facility, the cold storage was a lot larger than what we were using at the time, so we decided we'd get into more aged cheddar. For Gordon's, when we were first at Buck Grove, we were making cheddar for aging for about a year for them. So we decided we'd get into aging cheddar for at least 3 or 4 years. Nobody else was really going beyond two. Yes.
Do you age it in a cold storage or do
We do age it, but most of the cheddar we age it at about 38 degrees as opposed to the caves at 55. We do sell some cave-aged cheddar that we age in one of our four caves. It cures faster at 55, but you don't want to age it for 20 years because some of the bitterness and stuff would come out too fast when you cure it that fast. So a slow cure is the name of the game.
years?
What's that?
So, but if you have it in the colder
Takes
temperature,
a little longer to get there.
yeah.
Yes, correct. Yep. You slow down the process a little bit. Yep. So we started doing more aged cheddars, and we still were making mostly, let's say, commodity cheese. So Monterey Jack, Colby, cheddar for big distributors. Most of it was going out on pallets and being cut up and processed under others' labels, so it might be a store brand or that distributor's brand or whoever they sold to. Very seldom that it was under our own name. We would cut up some stuff at the factory and sell our own. But most of it, 99% or more, was going under other labels. So then we started doing the Dane County Farmers Market in 1994, full time. We had been invited before that. We had gone a couple times in 91, 92, but we started doing the Dane County Farmers Market full time in 94 and started getting our name out there a little more to the individuals and chefs and specialty stores. Chefs seem to have word of mouth with a lot of other chefs in the country. So we would start shipping cheese to other states, UPS,
Under your label.
FedEx, yeah, under our label. And so we kind of grew our label a little bit from there. One of the niches we had when we started at the market was some aged cheddar and also our world champion Colby. But by 1997, we decided we wanted to have another one. We started making blue cheese. So we started making our original blue, the Danish style blue, in 97. In 2001, we added Gorgonzola, an Italian style blue. In 2004, we added Blue Paradise, a double cream blue. We also started making Tillston Point, a washed rind blue. I don't know if any of you have had that, but that one was very time consuming to make. So we had to kind of put that by the wayside the last couple of years. If we were to continue making that one, we'd have to probably double or triple the price just because it's so time consuming. But we did add three more blues. 2009, we added a sheep milk blue, little boy blue. That one won first at the World Championship this year. 2011, we added goat milk blue. We called that one barn goat blue because that's where I started making cheese. And the first vat of the goat milk we got was from a farmer by Barneville that actually taught music in Barneville High School. We got goats on the side. So then 2013, we added a mixed milk blue called You Can't To Be Kidding. So we can't cover all three of that. So we started playing with more goat milk, the sheep milk, the mixed milk cheeses, triple play. We added triple play extra innings, I believe.
We have some out there tonight.
So we started making some of those too. The triple play, very first batch of triple play was February 2014. And Brian, my nephew that's planning on eventually buying us out, actually kept some pieces. We actually opened one of those last Friday, and it's like, it's almost sweet. It's 10 years old, and it's like the very first batch. You know, some of the things we've kind of tested along the way that we try to make or want to make. Of course, the first few batches, it's like, well, this isn't quite perfect. We need to tweak something here, tweak something there. But that one worked very well. So that one was a good one to begin with. Yes.
I haven't thought about this before, but what makes blue cheese blue? How is it different?
Sure. So when you make most cheeses, you add starter culture to the milk. And, you know, we'll pasteurize, start running milk into that. We'll add starter culture. Like with cheddar, we use a mesophilic starter culture. Colby, Monterey Jack, even the blue, we use a mesophile. But with the blues, we also add some adjuncts so that when you make the cheese, it kind of makes some openings in it so that when you pierce it, the blue can start growing. So we actually add the mold, the liquid mold, to the vat at the same time as the starter culture. So on a vat of 10,000 pounds, we add about 10 ounces. It's about 300,000 spores. We'll make the cheese, like let's say this week we'll make a gorgonzola on Wednesday. Next Monday we'll pierce that. So usually when you buy a wedge of blue, you kind of see some holes in the top. A lot of even chefs think that that's the blue being injected. It isn't. It's just to let air in so that the blue can start breathing. Mm. Once it gets oxygen, it can start growing. Huh. Give it the right conditions, you know, our caves, three and four are high humidity, about 98%, 55 degrees. So it only takes about 3 weeks to get as blue as you want them to be blue. But of course, you still want to cure them longer to get a nice flavor. So most of our blues we age about a year. The Blue Paradise, the Double Cream, breaks down a little faster. So we only age that one about 6 months. But the rest of them, we typically try to age a year. I don't think there's any other blue cheese makers out there that do that. You know, they want to, in the U.S., even if you've made it from pasteurized milk, now the regulations say raw milk cheeses have to be aged at least 60 days before you sell them. There are still some other cheeses out there that they won't let you sell before they're 60 days old, even if they're made from pasteurized milk, and blue cheese is one of them. So you have to age it at least 60 days, but many of the big makers shove it out the door in 60 days so I can get my money back. You know, they don't care about how good it is.
When you talk about a cave, you're not meaning a literal cave, are you?
Sort of. But if you've ever been by our factory, we're built into a big hill. So cave number one, when you walk up, you're actually walking uphill to get to it, it's still about 16 foot underground. But it is part of the building. So in the wintertime, that cave doesn't really need any air, you know, cold to keep it cold, or compressor to keep it cold, or anything running, because it's back in the hill, basically. So it does that itself. Naturally, the 2, 3, and 4 are closer to the vape room, so you still have to have a compressor to keep those chilled down a little bit. But yes, they are, I mean, we're mimicking caves. The problem with if you actually use a literal cave, most of them are big enough that you're going to have some food safety issues that you can't keep it clean, you know.
Oh,
So
cheese
that's right. I'm not sure we want to try that
that
one. Interesting, but yeah. Who survives, right?
way.
Kind of like the mushroom hunter, yeah. So, yes.
So you may be getting onto this anyway, but how many employees do you have and how have you grown just in terms of personnel?
Sure. So it was just my wife and I, and in the 90s, we had one employee for a while, and then it was us again. Then in, you know, I haven't gotten really into this, but in 2001, we switched from the big distributors. We just said, you know, we're done selling commodity cheeses. We're going to go all artisan specialty cheese and sell at the Dane County Farmers Market, chefs, restaurants we had picked up, specialty stores. And with the help of the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Innovation Board through the Department of Ag, we've gotten cheese out to other places. It keeps growing. So they really promote specialty cheese. They really want to push, show that Wisconsin has some of the best, if not the best, in the US and the world. And so they keep pushing our cheese and a lot of other small cheesemakers. And so what they'll do is they'll bring heads of stores in or chefs in to Wisconsin. They'll tour around to different factories. So it gets our name out to a lot of these places. So it keeps growing, you know, and we keep getting more contacts to deal with. So from us two, we're up to seven full time, one part time.
Thank you.
So roundabout way of answering your
Oh,
question.
thank you.
But yes, when we were making commodity cheeses, we were making about 1.5 million pounds of cheese a year. And that's pretty tiny this day and age with a lot of the big guys that will make 11 or 12 million pounds a day. Oh, yeah, I know. That means they're running millions and millions of pounds of milk because it takes 1 pound of, you get 1 pound of cheese for 10 pounds of milk. So, you know, the big places are getting so much milk in and they've got to run it through. They have no time to wait. Where if we have a slow vat or a fast vat, we know how to work with it, you know, where they've got a time constraint. Just push that stuff through. It's got to go out the door, you know, whether it's good or it's bad, you know, get it out of here. We got more milk coming in. So yeah, since 2001, we cut back. We built our way up from about 150,000 pounds a year of production to about 500,000 pounds a year of production. We're now, you know, dollar wise, we're about four times because we charge a decent price. I mean, hopefully we're not ripping people off, but when we were in the commodity business, you're basing everything on what is now called, the Chicago Merc price, cheese price, you know, and that's gone up just in the last few weeks about 20 cents. So it's like 220. Well, you know, try and get that and pay your farmer a decent price and make a living is very hard to do. So, you know, when we were making for 30 years commodity, we were working 80, 90 hours a week ourselves just to pay everything off. Nowadays, you know, I supposedly semi-retired in 2001, but I'm still back to about 70 or 80 hours. Just, but it's more fun doing things you really like to do as opposed to just working hard and hoping you're making something. But now we get to kind of play with recipes, try new things, kind of add things on. Actually, once in a while, like the Tillston point, you have to put things aside and say, you know, it's not cost effective. But yes.
Yeah. So two questions. Do you have your master's Master Chief certificate. I don't know what the
yes,
exact name
so
it is.
Master's Chief degree. So in Wisconsin, they started the master's program in 1995. So Wisconsin and Switzerland are the only two places in the world that you can actually get a master's degree in cheesemaking. So yes, I do have mine in blue cheeses and in cheddar. So, but yeah, the only two places you can get a master's degree. And part of that is Wisconsin is the only place in the nation that it requires a cheesemaker's license. Every vat has to be presided over by a licensed cheesemaker. You have to have your license for at least 10 years, be making that type of cheese for 10 years, and apply to get into the program. They come and interview you. Once you get into the program, you have to take several courses through UW, the Center for Dairy Research, UW-Babcock. And they test the type of cheese you're going in at least twice a year, at least out of four different vats, make sure they meet the grades that they should. And then after those 3 years, you get a take-home exam, and it's like 80 pages long. So you have to cite, you know, where you got all of these answers, and it takes about 40 hours to take the exam.
Wow.
They send it to you in the middle of October. You have to have it back sometime before Thanksgiving. So, yes, thank you for that and asking that. Yes.
When did you decide that you were going to do these ultra-age cheeses? When I want to take a very special gift to somebody, I get them a 15-year-old Hook's cheddar.
Yes,
yes. Yeah, sometimes a 20.
So, so, you know, like I said, when we first bought the facility in Mineral Point, it was bigger than we would use for commodity cheeses we were making. We started aging cheddars. And at that time, we thought we'd go to 5 years, 7 years, nobody else was doing it. But, you know, as we kept aging it, and when we do make cheddar for aging, so any of the cheddars, I'll have a sample block. We always have a sample block of every vat that we send in for testing. I'll pull a plug, we'll taste it. So when it's like 6 months, and then at about a year, so a couple times a year, I'll test every vat. So the sample block, and we thought we'd go to five or seven. And of course, some of these were really getting even better as they aged. So we decided we'd go to 10. The first 10-year we released was in 1999. The next, we released a first batch of 15 in 2009. Mm. And we only had that available for sale because we'd only have a smaller batch, usually around October, November, December. It's only the last couple of years we've had enough that we can sell that all year long. The 20-year, the first batch we released was in 2015, and we released one in 2020, one last year in May, and we'll have another batch next year in April. Last year's was white. First two were yellow. Last year's was white. Next April will be yellow again. But yeah, as they kept aging, we decided they seemed to be getting better as long as we tested them along the way. Naturally, out of all the cheeses, you know, about 70% could easily be aged that long. Naturally, it sells before that typically. But we're always looking for any hint of any off flavors along the way. Anytime there's anything that shows up, we need to sell that batch, you know, within the next several months, because it typically won't get better after something. A little bit of bitterness or whatever will show up. So you want to move it. But the rest of them could age longer. Main sales are between 3 year and 5 year. So about 70% of the cheeses are typically sold by the time they're 5 years old. But many of them would be able to age longer.
Have you aged any beyond 20 years?
Only in my daughter's refrigerator. I've got some 48.
So what is a bat?
What's that?
You're using the term bat, and I think of it, you know, a big kettle.
Yes. Yes. So a kettle, like they used to make Swiss cheese in, and I'm sure you've probably seen pictures of a copper kettle, right? Like you're talking.
Right.
So typically these days, the bats, the small people now, because the big people just use a big tank that's round and you would never see the milk and they never see the milk. Everything is computerized in one end. They never see it. Robots are stacking cheese on the pallets. If they drive the forklift to the cold storage, maybe, but they never see the cheese. But yes, ours are open vats. So they're the smaller vat, the 10,000 pound is about 20 foot long and 6 foot wide and about 5 foot deep. The bigger vat is about 30 foot long.
And the cheese is aged in that?
No. What happened? It's just being made in that.
Oh, okay.
So when we make the cheese, we start running it through the pasteurizer. We'll pump it from one of the holding tanks. So my milk hauler, I used to haul the milk, but my milk hauler now hauls it in the afternoon before, puts it in the holding tank, pumps it in the holding tank, and we pump it up through the pasteurizer and then into the vat. So as we start adding it to the vat, we'll add starter cultures because we want to ripen it about 50 minutes before we set it. So like with cheddar, we'll add the starter culture. It takes about a half hour to pasteurize the smaller vat, about 45 minutes to pasteurize the bigger vat. But ripen, so that means to let the bacteria grow to keep doubling about every 15 minutes. Then we'll set it with rennet. So we wanted it to be at about 88 degrees Fahrenheit. That's optimum temperature, 86 to 88 is optimum for bacterial growth. And we'll put rennet in. All mammals have rennet in their stomach to coagulate mother's milk. Years ago, they used to use calf rennet. Butcher the calves, soak the stomachs, get the rennet. And that was the Cadillac of rennets. Nowadays, they actually grow it on a fungus in a lab. And the chymosome is even a higher chymosome content than calf rennet. And that's the type of rennet we use, is the chymosome grown on a fungus. But we'll add the rennet, stir it for a couple minutes, and then just pull the paddles and let it sit for about 25 minutes on cow milk. Gets about as thick as like Greek yogurt. And then we cut it with wire knives. So the wire knives, so there's a framework, but there's wires running down and then horizontal on the other one. And we'll cross cut with a vertical, then we'll run up one side and down the other vertical horizontal. And what you end up with is little tiny cottage cheese size cubes. Because, like I say, out of 10 pounds of milk, you get 1 pound of cheese, 9 pounds of liquid. So there's got to be a lot of liquid kicking out of that. Cut it in those tiny cubes and the liquid will start coming out right away. And then put the paddles back in and start stirring and cooking. Cook it up to about 100 for cheddar. So the stirring and the heating keep kicking more moisture out. And then with cheddar, we'll let the curd settle at the bottom, drain the whey out, and start cutting that curd at about 100 and start it kind of knitting back together again. We'll cut those into slabs that are about so wide, about this long, turn them over. Every 15 minutes, we'll come back. We'll cut the first one in half. We'll double it up. 15 minutes later, we'll come back. We'll pile those three high. 15, 20 minutes later, we'll pile them four high. So what happens is, once you cut them in half, they're about this long. By the time you get to four high, they've stretched out about this long, but they've gone from this thick to about this thick. The texture changes. The bacteria start keep growing in there. And then we'll test the pH or the acidity of the whey, make sure the starter culture is still working like we want. And then we'll run them through the cheddar mill and make a large curd. So cheddar is typically the only cheese you would make curd twice. It changes the texture and the flavor of the cheese. So then once you mill it, we'll ditch it, but a little more way out. There isn't a whole lot coming out at that time, and then we'll salt it. The salt, just like heating to about 100, slows the bacterial growth down so it doesn't get real acidic and acts as a preservative and, of course, adds flavor. It's very bland without the salt. They keep telling us they want to regulate salt because sodium intake for everybody, but for making cheese, it's something, we don't want to cut way back on it because you're going to really affect the cheese. So we try to keep the finished product at about 1.75% sodium. But somewhere between 1.5 to 2 is optimal, 1.75. If you get out of those bounds, you're not going to affect it a whole lot if you're not too far out, but you want to keep control so that you don't affect the flavor of the cheese too much.
Fascinating.
What's that?
Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank
Yeah, one more question, then we'll switch over to Carol.
Yes.
Do you do tours? Are there?
So we have a viewing window. So you can come in and actually watch us making cheese because the vats are right below you.
Right there.
Yeah, and we're all working down there. And if I have time, I can come up. We've got kind of a picture book. I can go through that. So, So with six other employees, most of the time I have help. I have time to do that. But like on Fridays, curd day, it really slow. So sometimes I don't.
One last question. So give us the range of curds at the farmers market. We've talked about this before, but so what's the high mark and the low mark? And is it football season or what?
It's the opposite of what you'd think.
Really?
Football season, it actually starts going down. You'd think that would be the peak, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Yes. The peak is really around Memorial Day is the probably the biggest sales of curd and even cheese. But the first opening day of the outdoor market, if it's a nice, beautiful day, I mean, people come out of woodwork.
Yeah.
You can almost sell rocks. That is so rocks. But that day and Memorial Day are typically the best. And it's really weird. You'd think football season people would want that for right now.
Right.
But it seems to start going downhill on curd sales this time of the year.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, with that, we'll switch over to orange.
Thank you, Tony. If you have more questions, please.
And the art of retailing,
Yes.
Orange Schrader. Thanks so much.
Well,
The
thank
floor is
you.
yours. Yeah.
I'm delighted to be here. The last time I addressed this society, I was talking about Danish food. So we're not going to talk about Danish food, although cheese and blue cheese. I mean, I kept thinking all these cheese things to say, but I'm not supposed to talk about cheese right now. Of course, Denmark is a very big cheese making country, very important
Right.
to the Danes and blue cheese especially. So one of the questions I wanted to start by talking about is how I became a retailer. We just got back Wednesday from Boston, which was the first day of school for our 6-year-old granddaughter. And I had sent her a sign that you fill in each year, what grade I'm in, what my favorite color is. And I sort of planted this in her head, but where it says what I want to be with my what I want to do when I grow up. She wrote, "I want to work at Ernst & Young Hortz." That's not what I wanted to do when I was 6 years old. When I was 6 years old, I wanted to be a writer. And I was very set in that right from the beginning. When I was 9 years old, I somehow started reading Dickens. I can't quite imagine that now, but I guess I did. I became a very big Dickens fan. And when I was 12 years old, I asked my mother when I could go to England. Because I really wanted to go to England because I was such a big Dickens fan. She said, "Well, when you're 16." Of course, I'm writing this down, like, okay, 16, start saving my money. So 2 years later, in my small town in New Jersey, I met a fellow 14-year-old who was on a private exchange program from Denmark. Her parents had thought that it was a really good idea to send their 14-year-old daughter to America because they knew somebody in England who was coming to America. The father was from England and the mother was from India, I believe, and they had a 3-year-old. I'm not sure they'd ever met a 14-year-old. And Annette was a very independently minded 14-year-old, but she was 14. And if you've had a 14-year-old, you know that you don't send them off in the world by themselves, probably. but she arrived in our high school in New Jersey, and I still have the note that I passed to her saying, "Hi, my name's Carol. You're Ned, aren't you?" And she was just visiting a few months ago. We're still best friends. We're both not 14 anymore. She's a retired doctor. And there was a Danish magazine a few years ago that I came across a column called My Dearest Possession. And I wrote a story about how this note that I passed to Annette was one of my favorite possessions and that it meant so much to me. And they ran a few story. I don't know if she was embarrassed or pleased, but so Annette was a Girl Scout, and I was a very active Girl Scout. My mom was a Girl Scout. My dad was an Eagle Scout. And so Annette joined our Girl Scout troop. And I was very impressed by the fact that in her luggage, when she arrived in America, she had her scout uniform. Well, that would have been enough in itself, except that the scout uniform included a Smokey the Bear hat, which must have been terrible to pack, and a belt, the buckle of which was a beer bottle opener, and it had a knife. I mean, this was pre-9/11, obviously, but so she came equipped. And we became good friends throughout the year of Girl Scouts, our freshman year of high school. But it was not going well with her host family, and they decided to send her home. So her mother came to get her, and they said, "Oh, you must come visit us." And I said, "Good, I'm 14, I'll be 16 soon." But I'll keep it in mind. So a year passed or so, and Annette wrote and said, "So are you going to come come visit?" And I said, "Well, yes, but I really want to go to England." And so she found a bus tour of England, Scotland, and Wales that would take two unaccompanied 16-year-olds. The only problem was it was conducted entirely in Danish, of which I knew nothing. But when I got back to Pennington, New Jersey, where I grew up, we had an exchange student from Norway. And so I started learning a little Norwegian, went away to college in Boston at Tufts University. And of course, they didn't have Scandinavian studies, but this was during the hippie Vietnam War era. And they had something called Make Your Own Major through the Experimental College. And I said, "Well, I'd like to make my own major in Scandinavian studies." And for some reason, that included a lot of Viking stuff. But I don't know why we were studying the Vikings. And they found a tutor who taught German at Harvard, which is nearby, to come and tutor me in Norwegian. The problem was that everything he told me, he translated into German first and then into Norwegian. It wasn't going very well. But we found that there was a young Danish woman in the area. And there were a couple of us that wanted to learn Danish for some unknown reason. So we staged a sit-in. Again, this is early 70s. So we staged a sit-in in the German department because she said that she would teach us Danish in exchange for a sewing machine. It was a very short-lived sit-in because we were successful. So I started taking Danish. Second year of college, met my husband, Dean, who had just, well, he wasn't my husband, Dean, at the time, of course. He had just returned from a year in Germany. And so I said, "Well, it's great, you know, we're having a good time together, but I'm going to Denmark." And so he graduated, came back to Wisconsin, where he was from. I went to Denmark for my junior year. I skipped a year, so I graduated, lived with Annette, went to the University of Copenhagen, and then I had to decide what to do. Well, you were talking about this being the only one of two places in the world that you could get a degree in cheesemaking. This is one of five places in America where you can get a degree in Scandinavian studies. Mm-hmm. And Dean was from Wisconsin. He was working for his dad selling packaging machinery. So it was decided that I would apply to the Scandinavian Studies Department in Madison. And I was very excited because, as you heard, I was doing an independent study at Tufts. I was the only one studying Scandinavian studies and English. They forgot to give me my English degree, but I did get one, in case anybody cares. So it was arranged that we would move to Madison. I came back from Denmark. We lived for the summer in Milwaukee, where I got mugged. It's kind of a long story, but then we moved to Madison. And came up to the 13th floor of Van Hise Hall to the Scandinavian Studies Department. And the secretary said, "Professor Nielsen, she's here, the new graduate student." I was the only new graduate student. It was a very small class. There was one young woman my age who was continuing. She'd been an undergrad in Danish, and she was continuing. So at least there were two of us. But in April of our first year of graduate school, they mentioned to her that she needed a second language. And she said, "Yes, Latin." And they said, no, a second modern language. And she said, "I'm out of here." So I continued and got my degree in Danish. The reason I'm mentioning all this is, what do you do with a graduate degree in Danish? not much. You know, it's a bit of a limited field. My dear friend and major professor, Nils Ingwersen, had the only job that I really would have wanted. And I figured if he was assassinated, I would have been the prime suspect. So I was looking around for something to do. And my only work experience had been that my dad was a dentist. So I'd been like the world's worst dental assistant. I knew I was not going to go into dental assisting. But when I was at the University of Copenhagen, I had spent a lot of time wandering around, going into a lot of retail stores, because at the time there wasn't a campus for the University of Copenhagen. And I was living 45 minutes outside the city. So I had a lot of time between classes. They've sort of improved things since then, but this was a long time ago. So I thought, well, I should learn how to work in a retail store. And I don't know if any of you remember Board and Stoll. That was a Scandinavian furniture store here in the 70s and into the 80s. And so I asked if they needed a retail employee. And Janice Hopman said, no, but I'd like to learn Danish. I said, ha. <That's good." laughs> So we made it through a few Danish lessons. And she said, you know, I've just rented a new location for my campus branch on Monroe Street. Would you like to be the manager? So it was a wonderful opportunity. Unfortunately, I had never worked in a store at that point. And we opened it on October 3rd of 1974 and had a fantastic first day. And then the second day, the person who bought the chair the first day returned it. So we had like a negative sales. It was a little up and down. But one of the things that has in general been true in retail is that you have 30 days to pay for merchandise. So I've net 30. So during the fall, you know, we had a Christmas season and we were perking along pretty well. And then January 1st, Janice said, well, I've decided that the branch is going to pay its own bills. And we had a bunch of bills that were due because of net 30 from stuff that had come in during December. But she didn't put any of the Christmas money into the account for the branch. So then I got to learn about what it's like to be running a store when you don't have enough money to pay your bills. That was also a good lesson, I think.
Yes.
So as the spring went on, Dean and I decided that we would buy the branch. And Dean was still working for his dad selling packaging machinery. We coincidentally had bought a house about two blocks from the store. And every day at lunch, he would walk over with a tray with two bowls of soup on it. And we would have lunch in the store. And then he would be very reluctant to go back to selling packaging machinery. He really was not enjoying his job so much at that time. So we thought about, well, if we buy the store, maybe eventually you could come into business with me. We bought the store on and changed it to Orange Tree Imports on May 1st of 1975 with the idea that Dean would branch off and have his own store within a year or so. That never happened. So next May 1st will be the store's 50th anniversary, and we're still in business together. You've been in your business longer than I have. It's rare that I meet somebody that has that distinction. I didn't mention that during my brief stint at Tufts, my freshman roommate had nicknamed me Orange. And the name came from my hair, which I'm afraid I sometimes have to explain now. People say, oh, did it used to be red? Yes, redder. But the nickname came to Wisconsin with me because of Dean. I think if I had stayed in New Jersey or Boston, I probably would have gone back to Carol, because it was not a childhood name. It had only happened, you know, and in Denmark, I'm called Carolus Maximus in Suetuvna, which is Charlemagne the 27th. So the name Orange came with me to Wisconsin. And so in naming the store, we thought, well, what should we call the store? Board and Stole is Danish for table and chair. And we knew we didn't want to have it in another language, that nobody knew that's what it meant. And you know, so we decided to call it maybe Orange Imports, but we thought, well, it needs a little something, some consonants. So that's how it became Orange Imports. Nonsensical in a way. So Dean continued selling packaging machinery the first year, but his main interest, he decided, was either in selling cars, some sort of exotic car, I forget what it was, stereos, or kitchen cooking equipment. Mm-hmm. And we decided to expand that part of the business, and that became his part. So if you come into the office at Orange Tree Imports, one of the things that you'll see is that all of the files are his and hers. Dean has his vendors and his files for everything related to cooking and serving and food, and I have all the fun stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a difference in our working together. And when he came into business with me a year after I had been in business, it was a real challenge. I mean, you've worked with your wife for a long time, but there was a time when it was new to us, and it was difficult. I mean, I would second guess his decisions, but we worked that out quite a while ago. So Orange Tree Imports has a lot of departments, and I think that's been one of the secrets to success, that in addition to the kitchenware, we have toys, we have bath and body products, we have kitchenware, or Christmas and other holidays. We have a whole lot of different stuff. So we're like a mini department store rather than being focused just on cooking. And one of the things that, you know, Jim asked me earlier, what is your hot seller? But it really depends on what department it is. And over the years, of course. I mean, there was a time when soufflés were very big. But I bet none of you have made a souffle lately. But the advantage to having so many different types of merchandise is that we can ride the tide of it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That, you know, when one thing is really big and then something else isn't. And one of the things that's really hot right now is aprons and kitchen towels. I mean, go figure. That was the third biggest department last year. But one of the other things that sets Orange Tree Imports apart is... sometime in the early 80s, we heard a UW Extension professor speak at Lysistrata, which was a feminist coffee shop back in the early 80s. And his name was Garth Stone, I believe. And he was talking about participative democracy. And I'd never heard of this. And most people still haven't heard about it. It's a way of running your business, not as a co-op, because we are family-owned, but with your employees having buy-in. So he also had another part, which we did not do, which he said, just ask your employees what they want to be paid, and that's what they should earn. Even back then, that was not going to work. The one thing I don't like about retail is that the wages are low. I mean, there's no way we can compete with the University of Wisconsin or, you know, in terms of benefits and wages and such. We're very fortunate that we have employees who have been with us. I think the longest term employee has been with us almost 40 years. Oh, we have a staff of about 20, and quite a few of them have been with us a very long time. Unfortunately, that means they're getting old like we are, but we've been very fortunate to have staff that really feels that they're an important part of the business. And that's where the participative democracy comes in, that they either, almost everybody's in charge of a department, usually even the bookkeeper. And they do the displays, they restock the department, they have some say in what is bought for the department. Mm. And a number of our employees have grown into the point of doing buying. We also have a management team, and that helps us make all major decisions. And often there's a manager present when we're not present. So in the about 1992 or 94, I thought, you know, with a degree in Scandinavian studies, I've really learned a lot from doing it. So I decided to write a book about retailing. And this is actually the fourth edition. This one, I'm embarrassed to say, this book is a failure. I'm happy to own up to it. The first three editions were published by John Wiley & Sons, which is a major publisher. They sold 44,000 copies and were translated into Russian. John Wiley & Sons, probably very wisely, decided that they didn't want to continue publishing books about retail. And there are no other books about retail. I mean, mine is really like the last book about independent retailing, which puzzles me. So when they decided not to do it, I got an agent, and the agent shopped it around. Nobody wanted to publish a book about retailing, which tells you something. You asked about the challenges, and Amazon had come on the scene by then and was really very difficult to be an independent retailer.
Yep.
Sure.
So I went with a hybrid publisher in Milwaukee in 2018, and publish this book. And there are no bookstores carrying this kind of book anymore. And I don't want to sell it on Amazon particularly, because I'm anti-Amazon. And so we've sold very few copies of this. But, and then people will say, well, does it cover the pandemic? I thought, no, I didn't have a crystal ball in 2019. But I'm very pleased that at least the first 44,000 have helped a lot of people. And I even got letters from Russia from people saying that it really made a difference in their lives. So that feels very good. And it talks a lot about participative democracy and how getting people involved and making their jobs meaningful and also working around the rest of their lives is important, because a lot of retail businesses, especially the big stores, will let you know the week before your shift how many hours you'll be working and what days it will be. So you can't have, you know, classes that you're taking or other meaningful things that you're doing. So we try and make working in a retail store meaningful and enjoyable. And I still write a weekly blog for retailers and a column for a national magazine. So I have become a writer.
Yeah.
I've translated some books from Danish to English. And sort of a little known fact in my life is that I've also am one of the authors of a whole series of books on medical terminology. And that was not what I had in mind when I was six and said I wanted to be a writer. But my mom started a book, a textbook in medical terminology, and my daughter and niece and I have continued it. So Orange Tree Imports is actually a corporate structure where we are in the business of retail gifts and medical terminology textbooks. Unique in us. One of the things that I love about being in retail is the people. And I don't get to see people as much anymore because so much of our work is done on the computer. Mm-hmm. And of course, during COVID, we had a very difficult time during COVID. We were closed longer than most stores. We were open to 5 customers at a time, longer than most stores, and then 10 customers at a time. Then we went back to 5. We developed curbside pickup. Unfortunately for us on Monroe Street, we have an alley. Mm-hmm. So we were able to do curbside pickup. And I think that many of our customers bought things out of sympathy and wanting us to survive, which I will mention that Nutcrack, which is now called Fortune Favors Spice Nuts, was our biggest curbside pickup item. Oh. And one of the items that I feel kind of proprietary about, because Eric Rupert used to be a cooking school instructor for us, and he came in and told me that he was in charge of all the food at Epic, but that he hated his job and he wanted to start the Spice Nut Company and he wanted to call it Nutcrack. And I said, really? but he recently went national, and the national grocery stores had enough power that they said, we're not carrying something with the word crack in it. So now it's papers and papers. But one of the things I enjoy is helping people develop products, working with local artists. We now carry a lot of Wisconsin-themed gifts and local products when we can. We were talking before about how much of our products do come from China. And one of the challenges of that is that people don't want to buy things from China necessarily, but there either are not any other options or the price is such a big difference. So I'll give you an example. We used to carry 2 lines of cookware, one made in Wisconsin and one made in China. Same tri-ply construction, which means it's aluminum on the inside or on the core and then stainless on the inside and outside. And I would say, well, this one is X amount of money and it's made in China. This one is X amount of money and it's made in Wisconsin. Do you know which one they bought?
China.
Neither. Because it embarrassed them. You know, they didn't want to have to say, oh, good, I'll take the Chinese one. But they didn't want to spend the money or couldn't spend the money on the Wisconsin one. So that's, you know, those are some of the issues that we do deal with. The so biggest issue.
You're just carrying one of them now?
You know, the Wisconsin one I don't think is still made.
Okay.
But we did actually sell a lot of the Wisconsin one. I mean, people in Wisconsin do like Wisconsin made products, and if they can afford it, they wanted the locally made product. But probably the biggest problem we're facing right now is succession. You know, when Tony mentioned having his nephew in line to take over, we don't have that arrangement, unfortunately, and we're trying to figure out what the options are. Our son works in theater, which is what happens when you start taking an APT at a young age. And our daughter lives in Boston and is a registered dietitian, which is what happens when you suggest she gets some initials still behind her name if she's going to write medical terminology books. I do have MA behind my name on the MedTerm books, and nobody knows it's from Scandinavian Studies. So what, you know, we're trying to face some of those issues. My grandmother and my mother both worked until they're 80. I'm now 72 or 73, something like that. And so I hope I have some years left to keep Orange Tree Imports going. But it means so much to us that we're having the store's 50th anniversary next year and that we really feel well-loved by the community. And that makes me want to go to work every day. So thank you. But actually, I don't go to work every day. We don't work as many hours as we did pre-COVID.
So I believe I remember, Orange, that you established your online business, your catalog business, pretty early.
Well, we did a catalog business as part of a group of gourmet cookware catalogs based out of California, where we each put our own cover on a catalog and mailed it out to our customers. But at that point, it was to bring business into the store. We never wanted to do mail order where we have to package things up, in part because if you think about the range of things we sell, packaging is really difficult. So when COVID hit, The only thing you could buy on our website was my book and gift cards. And so we scrambled. I mean, Dean and I spent hours in the office by ourselves, which was a good thing because of COVID, adding things to the website and allowing people to then do curbside pickup. When COVID relinquished its grip somewhat, and I say somewhat because I have had so many people out with COVID lately, we went to BOPSIS, as it's called, which is buy online, pick up in store. And very few people take advantage of that. BOPSIS.
Really got good. It. Sorry,
Nick. Next counting letters I got. But one of the things that we haven't done is kept the website updated, because that would be a 40-hour-a-week job in itself. And we don't want to take the stuff off the website. So some of it we don't, you know, if people do place an order, we often don't have it, or the price has changed a little bit, but we still feel it serves the purpose of showing the range of what we carry. And if we ever have too much time on our hands, we can spend it updating the website. But
yes, obviously, COVID played a big role along the way. Did Biden's assistance to businesses?
Yes, all of the PPP, all those grants made a huge difference. We were able to keep the staff on. We were able to pay their health insurance. So yes, that made a big difference. And we are now back to our pre-COVID levels. However, there's been some inflation. So, you know, that's not necessarily we're selling quite as much. And also we're not open as much. We are suffering, as all businesses in this area are, from a lack of employees who can work all those extra hours. So we finally are back to being open 7 days a week, but we are not open any evenings, which we never did that much business in the evening anyway. And frankly, we were open five nights a week in order to compete with Walmart because they were open so many hours. But then Amazon came along and they're open 24/7. So it didn't seem that it was necessarily worth it. But we're hearing that nationally, independent retailers are down 5 to 20% this year. So it's election years are never great for business. And we're not down, so I'm very grateful for that. But we do 40% of our business in November and December. Our banker once told us that we were more seasonal than farmers. And so that Christmas season, and this year is a late Thanksgiving. But, you know, that's one thing about being in business 50 years. You kind of think, well, what happens, happens.
How bad was the book work that you had to do for those grants?
We weren't very busy doing other stuff, but yeah, it was a bit of book work. And I signed up for some program through the state of Wisconsin that I found out afterwards I didn't need to have signed up for. So that was disappointing, but, you know, it was all new to everybody. So we didn't know. It wasn't backbreaking, you know. It was worth it.
Yeah. I was wondering how have you survived Amazon? I mean, what's the secret there? Because don't people come and look at the price and then just go home and order?
You know, we'll never get back to our 2015 level probably of sales. I think that was when, you know, things really started being impacted by Amazon. The showrooming, as it's called, where people come in and look at stuff, is not as much of an issue now as we were very much afraid of that at first. My feeling is that if somebody comes in the store, they're generally motivated to support local business, so they're probably going to buy something. Mm-hmm. So, but it happens. It happens. And especially at first, that was a really big fear. And people would be on their cell phones and we'd be really paranoid and take a picture or something. But now we know that people are on their cell phones all the time and they're sending a picture to their sister to say, do you want this? Mm-hmm. So we don't get too freaked out about it. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that you have an experience advantage at this point? And I ask this because...
Really what?
An experience advantage. I ask this because, you know, we don't buy much from Amazon, but once in a while, there's something. And it's interesting over time how they have played games with their search response. I mean, it's fascinating. You say, I want this specific thing, right? You know, I don't know, toothbrush, you know, whatever it is. And you'll get back just this mess. And what strikes me about this, because it seems pretty consistent now, and it's because they're getting so much money for advertising. You know, their advertising business is enormous.
Yeah.
So they're essentially spamming the search response with all this stuff that people are paying to place. So I wonder if that plays well for you and independent businesses who have survived, because you can actually walk in and get the straight story.
Sure.
It's, you know, as opposed to this mess.
There is that. You walk in and you can walk out with something.
Yeah.
And what we love is you often walk out with something you didn't know you wanted.
Right.
So we have to make it a pleasurable experience as much as we can for people to walk in and browse around. Mm-hmm. But there are some things you will not find in a locally owned store. I always use the example, this was pre-Amazon when I used to talk about how to compete with Walmart, but plastic storage tubs. You're not going to find a local specialty shop that carries plastic storage tubs. So I don't really care if you buy them from Amazon or except for the shipping. I mean, we try and be environmentally conscious, and we know that shipping a plastic tub from somewhere else compared to walking into Walmart even and buying it is not so good. But yeah, the instant gratification is definitely part of it. And, you know, walking out with something and you can see the quality of it and you, you know, had a chance to feel it and touch it.
Mm-hmm.
So we try, we do our best, and I hope that we'll keep going for some time. And next year, I'm very excited about celebrating the 50th.
Oh, that's so thrilling.
Speaking of writing and Denmark, you have other books?
Oh, well, I have the book about Danish food. I forgot about that one. Yeah, my daughter and I wrote Eat Smart in Denmark, which is my last talk at literary
club
was about that.
How tough was the research?
Yeah, that was really fun.
So how about finding suppliers? How has that changed in the arc of 50 years dealing with, you know, buying and just all that?
That has changed a lot because our main source of merchandise used to be going to the Chicago Merchandise Mart and to the McCormick Place gift show in Chicago. And then there was a gift show in New York and L.A. And now there is no show at all in Chicago at all. And the Minneapolis Mart, which has always been a small mart, is in the process of sort of folding. The big shows are in Las Vegas and Atlanta. So Dean and I actually went to Las Vegas. It was only 105 when we went to the
planet. Right.
But there is a website called Fair, which has made a huge change. They launched almost at the same time as COVID. And because people couldn't go to gift shows, it became a very big deal, a little bit controversial, but they are a portal for vendors. So they don't sell themselves, but, you know, you might find different vendors and you can order through Fair. They collect the money, but the supplier ships the merchandise. And I at the Las Vegas gift show, I found this Irish line of soap called Innis. I think that's how they pronounce it. Does anybody know that kind? You're going to Ireland, you'll have to look for it. And I got very excited about it. I've seen it before, but I thought, yeah, I need a new line. This would be great. And they just wrote back to me and said, we're not going to sell to you. We are zip code protected. And there's somebody else in your zip code who has it. And which is not true. It's actually the soap opera, which is, they're not in our zip code. But I thought, with Fair, there's no loyalty. Anybody can order anything. And I thought, this was so touching. So I said, okay, fine. But, you know, for that kind of protection and sales reps who get commission and such, Fair is undercutting all that. So in a way, it's making a shift in the wholesale part of the business, similar to Amazon.
Yeah, exactly.
So, on the other hand, it's super easy. And if I put in the word Wisconsin, I can find small vendors. Like I'm ordering some candles from northern Wisconsin. They would never have been at the gift show. They would never have had a sales rep.
They would never have been able to go.
So I'm finding companies that I wouldn't have found that way. So that ends up so I can do it at home at night on my iPad in bed.
Supply chain.
Yeah, which is one reason people buy from Amazon. So they can do it at night. QVC, their biggest time is like 3 a.m. It's a I don't want to run over my time, Joe.
No. Any other questions for? Go ahead.
One question, actually, both you, Carol, and Tony. I feel like you're both so innately creative, and that's something that you constantly have to feed, I imagine. So, what are some of the things that are a source of creativity with your crazy flavors and your beautiful windows and, you know, just sort of the novel approaches you have to the way the store is?
Well, I would say that it's participative democracy that I give credit for because it's actually my stock person who does all our windows. And in any other job, she used to work for Pier One.
Mm.
I'm sure they didn't say, oh, and would you like to unpack things and do windows? So, you know, the fact that she can use that creative aspect of her outlet. But also I've been doing it long enough that I feel like I have some skills as a buyer and I love exercising those and finding new things and I get excited about it. So, Tony?
Same thing. It's kind of seeing thing all the way through your life. You know, you're testing different things, and it's like, you know, I might be able to do that or come up with something that adds this to this. And so sometimes it doesn't always work out, but other times it's like, wow,
This is great.
Well, you know, it reminds me that you ended your talk by saying that it was like selling rocks. I actually turned down the pet rock. I said, this is a stupid idea. It's not going to sell. You want some, you lose some. I could have done really well.
I have a question for Tony. You said that when you got out of high school, you started working for the cheesemaker.
Yep.
Did you ever see yourself at that point being a cheesemaker?
Not really.
Or you just started to really love it?
Throughout life before that point, I would have never even thought I was going to make cheese. I just started working at the local factory, summer job, while I went to college. And when I went to college, I actually got my business degree and minor in accounting. Well, by the time I was through college, that was the business I knew. So that's kind of what I stuck with. And, you know, we were married young and had kids young, and you better work and raise the family, right? So that's kind of the job we stayed in. You know, like I say, 30 years of making commodity cheese, it's like farming. It's very, very hard. So do you want to continue doing that? But when we decided to cut back and just do our own brand, then it became fun, you know. Then you kind of have more control over it, and you see your name out there. And, you know, at the farmer's market, it's great that we sample everything at the outdoor market. People come up and try it. They might not buy it the first couple times or whatever, but they get to try everything we have. Oh, I don't like this one, or I do like this one. But you got feedback directly from the consumer, you know. So it's always fun to know people love your product.
We do.
Yes.
So what kind of a cheese market is like artisan cheese now? Like what, if you look at the cheese universe, how much of shifting?
Is it
like brewing? Like do you have,
are
people shifting into being artisan cheesemakers?
I mean, a lot of small, really small ones you would consider artisan. Some of the bigger factories that do some specialty items, small people would consider that artisan, but they just call it specialty because they're producing it on a larger scale. But Wisconsin has got about 40% of the factories that makes at least some type of specialty cheese. Artisan itself, you know, there's probably about 25 of us that are really small. There's 125 licensed cheese factories in the state right now. And in 1930, when we overtook New York as a dairy state, there were 3,200 cheese factories. So, it was the transportation. So every farm had a few cows, milk. Some cow had extra milk. They had to have a local factory to take that milk to because transportation was terrible. There was no trucking really to speak of. Cheese went to Chicago or Milwaukee by rail, not by truck typically, things like that. So, you know, they had to be able to take their milk to the factory and go back home and do all their chores and plant crops, et cetera, et cetera. So there was one every 2 miles up and down every road in Wisconsin, you know, and you can see a lot of those buildings now, long and narrow and kind of built into a side of the hill. So the back end was kind of their cooler area because no refrigeration really to speak of. So, you know, as transportation got better, things started consolidating, you know, so just like the Abilene's of the world. A lot of the places are bigger, but luckily there are some of those small artisan places still left.
Jack has a question.
I was just wondering, first of all, both of you have really interesting stories and you presented them very well. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
With you, Tony, I was wondering, have you thought about expanding into Europe and other places? Because it sounds like you're getting a good share of the market.
We are in about 40 states, but I mean, there's still huge market potential here in the U.S. Yes, it would be a good spot. I think what scares me is the paperwork.
You know, well, the follow-up would be what the local, I can just imagine you're going over to France and trying to. But your product is probably better.
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Export Council actually is getting about 50 pounds of our cheese to take to a thing for export for France right now.
Wow.
They're getting it in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
I better check and see if we sent that today. But, yeah, I mean, it is something we have thought about. It's just what scares me, like I say, I should hire somebody to kind of do more of the paperwork thing. You know, I'm not as computer literate as I should be, but.
That's not the part of the job you really like.
No.
Right.
That's one of the jobs I really don't care for. Yes.
Tony, are you aging any Swiss cheese these days?
The oldest we have available is 5 year. Yes. Yes. Okay. We haven't really gone beyond that. I mean, we have aged some up to 7 or 8, but we don't have very big quantities. So even though, you know, it may say 5 on the label, it might be 6 or 7 years.
Okay. It's really aged Swiss is very good.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is, unlike the cheddars, the Swiss isn't, you know, 100 years ago, Swiss was one of the main things in the U.S., but cheddar nowadays, actually the biggest production item is mozzarella for pizzas. And
yeah.
Mozzarella surpassed cheddar for production quantity in about 5 or 6 years ago.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yes.
Well, for both of you, what is the greatest obstacle that you had confronted in the long arcs of your careers? I'm interested if it came early or, you know, in the middle with changing markets. Or
I would definitely not say early because we didn't know. I mean, we went into business without knowing. We weren't risking anything. I mean, we had bought a house, but we didn't have children for 8 years after we started the business. And so if we had decided to stop after 2 or 3 years, it wouldn't have mattered very much. Today, I think there's a lot more on the line. It's very hard to borrow money to start a business. So I think that, but the biggest challenge I would say before COVID had to be Amazon, because we haven't had local competitors that we really felt were going to make it impossible for us to continue. You know, we've had well-respected local competitors, but Amazon has really been a challenge.
Our biggest was probably early on, you know, when we went out on our own because we were making commodity cheeses. And so the price points were so close, you know, the margins were so slim that it was harder. Like I say, we had to work a lot of hours to keep doing it ourselves. The only, besides COVID, the only thing now is, with the Food Safety Act about 12 years ago, there's so much more paperwork now. You know, everything you do, you better be writing it down. Mm-hmm. Lawyers always say, you know, if you have a recall, if it wasn't written down, you didn't do it, you know, for cleaning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and testing.
You don't want to be Borset.
What's that?
You don't want to be Borset.
You're not. I feel terrible about that. I don't know how big they are or if they're going to be able to survive that, but you don't want to be killing people either. So, yeah, I mean, it's very hard. So, yeah, you really want to be on your game, and I understand that. Is it going overboard? I don't know. But, yes, you do need to still make sure that things are the way they need to be food safety-wise. The other thing, like she said, with COVID, you know, we're in a food business, so we got to keep running. You know, you had to close down. But 60, 65% of our sales are to high-end restaurants. Well, you know what happened to restaurants that year? So we actually were very fortunate that the end of 2019, we actually picked up a specialty chain BJ's on the East Coast, and they're in about 13 states, and they did a run on our blue cheese for about a year. So from December 19 to December 20, they were getting quite a bit of blue cheese from us. And I mean, we were down that year, 2020, about 8% sales. And we typically are up about 10% year over year. And without them, we'd have probably been down about 35%. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that we kind of lucked out on that one. Mm-hmm. But yes, COVID, I think, affected everybody.
Yeah.
Of course, stores, things like that, you know, they transferred to where you could actually pick up outside, or they even delivery, you know, and that worked for them. Even restaurants kind of learned to do a lot of that. That's mm-hmm. what a lot of them had to do to survive. But yeah, that was a learning experience.
Well, you said the 30-day rule or whatever. I didn't quite follow that.
Net 30. Traditionally, an invoice for merchandise is due 30 days after the merchandise has arrived.
Oh.
But now a big change in the business is that it's almost, well, not almost all, but a large percentage is paid by credit card. So obviously you could play the float there, but mm-hmm. That's one way that Fair has taken in all of these smaller companies and some of the larger companies, because billing was such a hassle. You would bill a shop in Paducah net 30, and 60 days later they wouldn't have paid yet, and you'd have to be calling them and saying, I haven't gotten our payment. Fair is tied to one credit card, and it's net 60 on the credit card, so they don't bill it right away. Mm-hmm. So I was very surprised when I flew, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, I was flying somewhere, and I had not flown because of COVID. And they said, oh, you're Gold Elite. I said, what? And then I realized that it was my Delta card that was paying. So that's been a change in the business. And some of our accounts, if we buy Christmas merchandise and get it shipped in June and July, because most of our Christmas merchandise is in already, we don't have to pay until Christmas. So that's one way that they get us to take it earlier. So there are different traditions of.
You raise an interesting question, Maureen, because I remember talking with Dick Burke, who was owned Trek Bikes and really grew it many years ago. And he was a connoisseur of financial statements. He knew how to distribution company really was his thing. And he always marveled at Walmart, because Walmart, they would get the product, they would turn it within a few days, and then they'd have the cash, and they would pay in 60 to 90 days typically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just think about a big entity or Amazon, right? And any of these things that are fair, even probably, you know, they're playing with the money.
Exactly.
And where the small retailer, you know, oh, my God, they don't have that.
Well, and if we took 60 days or 90 days to pay, we would be cut off.
Right.
Traditionally, the department stores take a large deduction from broken merchandise,
right.
And they don't pay on time.
Right.
But my understanding is that Amazon does not make its money from selling merchandise. It has all these
ancillary, but yeah, the advertising is huge now. That's why you get such
credit services, yeah. And some sort of
fulfulfillment and cloud computing, really, yeah, all that. Any last question? Go ahead.
Now that especially since COVID, people are paying more with credit cards, how much is that?
I would say that now at least 80% of our sales with customers are credit card, 90% or more. Mm-hmm. You know, no bounce checks, but we never got that many bounce checks. Yeah. Counting the money at the end of the day doesn't take as long. Mm-hmm. You know, we do pay 3% or 3-4% for credit card fees, mm-hmm. but it's a convenience for our customers. And that's another big change that's happened.
Yeah, I was thinking that before that, I usually would always pay with cash, and then credit card,
sorry. And another challenge that we're facing is the demographics of our customers. You know, looking around the room, we are all aging, some more than others, of course, but people don't need as much when they get to be older, you know, when they move into Oakwood or whatever, and their kids don't necessarily want so much stuff either. So Christmas ornaments, this is a little aside, but there's a wonderful capital
Wisconsin State Capitol ornament every year. And the woman who started this had a passion for the preservation of our Capitol building. So we sell the ornament. I don't know if we actually lose money on each one, but we don't make more than 50 cents or something on each one. And so we do it to help her out. And she just brought this year's, which is the dome. It's gorgeous. But I said, you know, people my daughter's age don't buy Christmas ornaments. They decorate a tree. They might put some homemade ornaments on it, but they're, I said, why don't you do one next year that has a prism hanging from it so it can be a window hanging? Mm-hmm. So we went through some discussion about whether that might be feasible, because a Christmas ornament has, I mean, it's limited to people who have a Christmas tree, right? Which is not everybody. And we used to sell a lot of Christmas ornaments. Now we're selling, when I order ornaments, which is something I love to do, I always think of who is going to give this to somebody else as a gift. Whereas a lot of stores used to say, oh, I'm doing a peacock tree this year. These are all my peacock ornaments for the consumer who wants to have a peacock tree. Now, in Madison, Wisconsin, there was never a consumer who did a peacock tree. So I never ordered the way they did anyway. But most people don't buy ornaments for themselves. They give it to somebody else.
Hundreds.
Anyway, so that's the kind of thing that I enjoy keeping tabs of.
Totally. All right. Any other questions?
Fascinating.
How important was the grocery location to your success?
What was that?
When
we opened on Monroe Street, it was still on the cusp of being a neighborhood street with a grocery store and a pharmacy every few blocks. You know, that's how it had grown up in the 30s and 40s. So we were one of the first specialty shops. And also I, together with someone else, I founded the Monroe Street Merchants Association, because we discovered that the businesses didn't know each other and didn't cooperate with each other. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that that would be an important part to our success. And it has been. So I love being on Monroe Street.
Mm-hmm.
Monroe Street Festival, September 21st. The first year that I'm not in charge at 46 years.
Congratulations.
Wow. We'll see if it lasts.
Wow.
The person in charge this year said she's not doing it next year.
it may get a pack.
And you also had to survive the street construction.
The street construction in 2018. We have 1 year between the street construction and open.
Association is so important.
The
promotions that you did for
to keep the street going that year. Yeah, that was a challenge, but it came out very well. It looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't we all enjoying the rapid transit street changes?
Another topic. All right.